Okay, well, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the sixth edition of the DMSC Masterclass. This monthly class is for current DMSC students and faculty and those interested in the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences, AT Still University. This allows us to hear from inspiring masters in the PA profession and those in healthcare who have made a difference. So a few housekeeping issues for those of you who are here. Please keep your microphones on mute. Please make comments in the chat session if you have any comments during the presentation. And once we're finished, we'll open it up to questions and you can unmute yourself. Dr. Beth Popray, our administrative manager of the DMSC program, will monitor the chat for any questions or comments. So, but let me take a minute to, I'm really excited about this, to introduce our guest today, Dr. Bill Kohlhepp. William Bill Kohlhepp, DHSC, PA-C, has been a PA for more than 40 years, having graduated in 1979 from the UMDNJ and Rutgers PA program in New Jersey. Dr. Kohlhepp has been active in the national professional organizations of the PA profession since serving as National Student Secretary in 1978. In fact, Bill, I think you served with my good friend Steve Nunn from Arizona.
I did indeed. Arizona boy made well.
That's right. In January 2021, he became a member of the Board of Trustees of the PA History Society. He recently served as president of the PA Education Association. He's past president of the American Academy of PAs, past speaker of the AAPA House of Delegates, past chair of the AAPA board. He's also served as chair of the NCCPA board and is also president of the Connecticut Academy of PAs. Recently, Dr. Kohlhepp retired from Quinnipiac, having been awarded the title of Professor Emeritus of PA Studies. He's been involved for almost 25 years in higher education leadership, beginning in the PA program in 1996 as academic coordinator, progressing through to become associate director of the graduate PA program in 2002, and then the director of undergraduate PA education in 2007. He joined the Dean's Office of the School of Health Sciences in 2010, where he served as associate dean for 3 years, beginning in 2014. He served for a short time as associate vice president for academic faculty affairs before becoming dean of the Quinnipiac University School of Health Sciences in 2015, a position he's held for more than 4 years. He holds a doctorate in health science from Nova Southeastern University back in 2007. I can't believe that. Where does the time go? And a master's in health administration from Quinnipiac University in 1997, earned a bachelor's degree in biology from the University of Connecticut in 1974, and has received an honorary doctorate, let me underline this, an honorary doctorate of humane letters from AT Still University in March of 2000, where he was the ASHS commencement speaker. Dr. Kohlhepp received a Lifetime Achievement Award from PAEA in 2020, was named the ConAPA PA of the Year in 2019, received the National Student Academy's President's Award in 2010. And the same year, he was awarded the James Marshall Award for outstanding service to the university by the Quinnipiac University Faculty Senate. He was recognized as PA of the Year by the American Academy of PAs and Occupational Medicine in 2006, and is past recipient of the Distinguished Alumnus Award School. And I'm looking at my notes, Related Professions, University of Medicine and Dentistry, New Jersey. Anyway,
big title for that university.
It is, you know, and there's more to say, but, you know, Bill, I'm just going to cut to the chase and just welcome you to our masterclass this evening.
Thank you for that kind introduction, Randy. I know I've caused a little bit of trouble in the profession, but to hear it all sort of strung together like that over a few minutes, just mind-boggling. And I have known you for a long, long time, and whenever you ask me to do anything, I'll say yes. So this was great to do this.
Well, that's good, and we've got that recorded now. So
that's a good point.
let's get right to it. You know, Bill, you started your career as a clinically practicing PA and a practice administrator. Let's go back you know, to that period of time, and just share with us what drew you to the PA profession, and really tell us about your early clinical practice.
So I'm a big believer in life that sometimes the doors close and a window opens, or the universe gives you opportunities if you're paying attention. I was a pharmacy student at the University of Connecticut and said, I don't really want to do that. And then I became a pre-med student because, of course, that's the thing to do. If you want to go into healthcare, it's either doctor or nurse. And I sort of did not apply myself extremely well. And I wasn't very serious about it. And I started getting interested back again in going to graduate school in pharmacology. But my roommate in my senior year, who we shared organic chemistry class together as a juniors, so that bonded us, and we were both from New Jersey. He said in December, he was a semester behind me, I guess a semester ahead of me, because he graduated in 4.5 years. And he said, I'm going to PA school. And I said, what is that? And he tried to describe it to me. And I said, good luck, have a good life. Never heard of it. Don't know what you're doing. And he went to the Columbia Presbyterian School of Ophthalmologist Assistant to be an assistant to ophthalmology physicians in the specialty era of PAs. And then he became a member of the first class of Rutgers, and I still wasn't really paying attention until we traveled together from New Jersey to where I was living at the time. And we went up to a football game at UConn. And I listened to him talk about clinical rotations, and I said, oh my gosh, this is exactly for me. And at the time, I was working for a pharmaceutical company doing experiments on guinea pigs and mice and rats, and sitting in a lab as a pharmacologist, assistant pharmacologist, saying, I can't do this for the rest of my life. I really hope I get into PA school. And I was accepted into the third class of Rutgers, and it's a decision that was the most important of my life, even more than decision to get married and other things. It just has even led me to my wife, my decision to go to PA school. We can talk about that along the way if you want. But so my early clinical practice, Rutgers in 1979, when I graduated, was in the next to last state in the country that refused to license PAs. I graduated in a state where it was illegal to be a PA, and it stayed illegal till 1992. And so I had to go somewhere, but I had some friends from the AAPA in Connecticut, and I said, I'll try to go to Connecticut. And I picked a border, any border, and I went north. And I started working, I think my career is a good testament to the opportunity to change specialties as a PA. My first position was in an emergency room in an inner city at Yale New Haven Hospital in the surgical section of the emergency room. I then went from there to a staff model group practice, HMO, worked in internal medicine as part of a PA physician team for 2 years. And then I got an opportunity to run a practice at a satellite where it was going to be half-time family medicine PA and half-time clinic administrator. And that built on some of the experience I had gotten in the profession and leadership. And that launched my career, where I did the second phase of my career, which was hospital administration. I did that for 4 years. And then I went and answered an ad in the newspaper that was put in the paper by my wife, who was the head of HR at the Hospital St. Raphael. And said, for a good time, call Peggy Dillinger. And It said, if you want to run an occupational medicine practice from the ground up and you're a PA, come join us. And I was there for about 10 years in full-time clinical practice before I went to teach at Quinnipiac. So I was in surgical emergency medicine, internal medicine, family medicine, and occupational medicine. And my first part of my career was actually doing clinical research at Yale New Haven Hospital. I was grant funded for my first 2 years, and I got a publication. It spurred my interest in scholarly endeavors. My first publication was in New England Journal of Medicine as a PA. So
wow,
not bad. it was great. And I think positioning myself in the state of Connecticut was another great factor in a very successful career.
You know, Bill, let's back up a little bit back to PA school, as we talked about one of your first professional roles as a PA student was with the Student Academy.
Yeah,
and talk a little bit about that. I mean, that was way back when. I'm not sure that the Student Academy had much of a voice as much as they do now, but what prompted you to get involved in the Student Academy?
So again, you know, you have to pay attention to the universe. So my class, so the first class of the Rutgers PA program, physicians and nurses said, oh, yeah, it's a fine idea. Second class, physicians and nurses said, okay, it's a fine idea. Third class was accepted when the first class was about to graduate and everybody said, time out. What do you mean we're going to let PAs practice in New Jersey? No, no, no. And there was one PA in New Jersey who worked in a federal institution at a VA hospital, Mary Ann Ramos. And she worked with my class to help form the State Society, the New Jersey State Society of PAs. And we formed the student chapter of the PA Student Society in New Jersey. And we knew we couldn't do it with just the guidance of Mary Ann, as smart as she is and as passionate as she is. And we went, said, we got to go to the APA meeting in Houston. And I had a really good campaign manager, Bob Caffone. He was in the first class. And I don't know what happened, but suddenly I got elected National Student Secretary. I wasn't drinking that much, so I don't know how I got elected. But that was another key thing, was to say yes to that opportunity when it was when someone said, why don't you run for Student Academy Secretary? And Steve was I guess he was from Bowman Gray. I don't know where he was from.
Right, Bowman Gray. That's
Bowman
right.
Bowman Gray. They were very involved. Don Asayadoff was from Yale, and Sandy. I can't remember where Sandy was from, but it was great to be part of that crew. So, but it was really the need to have the collective voice of the profession work together to help elevate New Jersey, and we needed help, and I knew we needed to get involved. It was a tremendously important resource.
Well, you know, and I was at that Houston meeting, and, you know, I think you'll agree that things happen in our lives and opportunities occur. And if you step into it, you get to be at the table. And so as a student secretary, there you are at the table of the AAPA.
Yeah.
In the early years of the AAPA, when the Academy was still trying to figure out what this thing was all about.
Yeah, and all four of us were members of the board of directors. It wasn't just the Student Academy president. All four of us were members, and there were 25 student delegates. And if all 25 votes voted against something that was a bylaws amendment, the Academy couldn't pass it. We had that much power. So we parlayed that power into a more, we had no funding either. So we parlayed that into, we'll give up some power if you give us some source of funding for the work of us as students. So that worked out pretty well.
Yeah. And that sort of, in my mind, gave you an opportunity to see what was happening, not only at the state level, but at the national level with the Academy. And you know, fast forward, you know, you're past president of the PAEA, former director of the NCCPA and chair, and I had the honor to work with you on the commission for many years. What prompted you to get involved in the professionalism of the profession? I mean, that's a lot of work, Bill. You know, and you're trying to you know, work at a education and like that. I mean, how do you do that?
So, you know, if you think about socialization as a PA, that comes from being involved with others who are PAs. And here I'm in a state where there are no PAs, and my socialization and my sort of kicking the tires and saying, is there really a profession out there, was going to the national conference and saying, yes, this is a viable profession. Yes, this is doing well. But it really came from saying, this is a very young profession. And if I wanted to head in the direction that I think makes sense from my viewpoint, not that I'm the smartest kid in the class, but if I want my ideas at the table, I better be involved. And that desire to help shape the profession came from both a hope, wanting to see my hopes and dreams for the profession come about, but it also came from a heartfelt passion where this profession is unbelievable. And it needed everybody's energy at that time to get things accomplished. And, you know, we had a commencement speaker to Quinnipiac a couple of years ago, and he said, your life will be much more full and rich if you say yes more often than you say no. Now, work-life balance, I think the younger generations have figured out that that's important. But, you know, my wife understands that this is an important part of who I am. And some days she tolerates it, and most days she encourages it and values it. But, you know, my two boys never, ever, ever, ever saw me on Memorial Day until about 3 years ago when the Academy stopped meeting on Memorial Day. And it was like, yeah, we don't ever see Dad on Memorial Day. So it's like, okay. Because that was when the House of Delegates was. So,
yeah, that reminds me, Steve Nunn always tells me he had his two children, and they're all born in the latter part of May. And he would miss their birthdays every year. Ooh, you know, bad. So and they never cease to remind him about that even today. So
I can see that.
Bill, I mean, we could spend hours on your longstanding service to the profession, but correct me if I'm wrong. You have something that a few leaders have, and what's what I call the trifecta. That is that you've been AAPA president, you've been the chair of the board of the NCCPA, which is sort of like being president of the NCCPA, president of PAEA, and if I remember right, also speaker of the House. So, how do you stay involved? I mean, you talked about the early days and the importance of standing up, you know, but over the years, there must be some reason for staying involved.
So, you know, I truly feel like it's part of who I am to be professionally involved. It is an integral part of Bill Colhip. It's not something I do on the side. It really is truly something that I just get so much out of. And I just recently went to the PAEA meeting, and we hadn't met for 2 years. And seeing people that I have known, a couple hundred PAs that I've known for years. And it's just a magical group of people who are involved in the profession. And I just love that part. It is a small group. One person, Paul Lombardo, has been the chief executive officer of four organizations. And Rick Roars has been the chief executive officer of three, as have I. But I also was speaker, and nobody counts that as anything, but
I do.
That was my favorite position of all of them in the world. Being Speaker of the House of Delegates is a fabulous position. And you know, you asked the question about keeping involved. I couldn't not be involved, but at the same time, I didn't want to hold other people down. I really liked finding aspiring leaders and encouraging them and mentoring them and tapping them on the shoulder and saying, Robert, you should do this. You're really good at this. And I have some really people who have been leaders of this profession who I know I had conversations with and encouraged them. And if I kept saying, well, I'm going to stay president or speaker or whatever for a whole bunch of years, then I'm going to keep others down from those opportunities. So my strategy was to move to a different organization. And even with PAEA, I was treasurer for 6 years before I was ever PAEA president. And, I was surprised. I went to NCCPA at a time when AAPA and NCCPA were like this. And nobody on that board trusted me for anything. And I can't imagine that I think, a testimony to my skill to build relationships with people that they ever trusted me to be chair, because my first meeting, they wouldn't even second my motion. My second meeting, they wouldn't even second my motion. So that one was a tough one. But, you know, it's, and even now, the PA History Society is something I've always said, you know, a couple people, Fred Tadler and others, have said to me, you should join the PA History Society. I said, well, I'm doing this now. down the road I'll do that, and now I'm doing it, and I'm having a. It's nice to think about PA history. So, but
very good. Well, let's talk a little bit about being a PA in PA education. I mean, a huge responsibility. You know, many of our DMSE students are either in our PA education track or in our leadership track, you know, or and are interested in leadership opportunities. As you said, you know, you didn't want to put a ceiling or push down anybody with an opportunity to move in. But, you know, many of our students tell me, I don't know how to get involved. So thoughts?
Yeah, so I think one of the challenges of getting involved in any professional organization is the opportunities that you see are often the most visible opportunities, and everybody wants to do that. They want to be on conference planning. They want to be on government affairs. They want to be on the education group, whatever. And so it's the behind the scenes things that you say aren't visible to you. And they don't seem like, oh, what is that? So I don't even know what it is. My very first committee was the elections committee of the AAPA, and it built on me saying, I want to help count ballots in the House of Delegates. I held up my hand in the House of Delegates and said, who wants to count ballots? And I said, I'll do it. And I had 10 fingers, and that worked really well. And they were very impressed when I took my shoes off and counted to 20 using my toes. Then an opportunity came. Nobody wanted to be on the elections committee. My elections committee was Paul Lombardo, future AAPA president, and I just mentioned him, Libby Coit, future AAPA president, Bill Kohlhepp, future AAPA president, Jan Gallant, who went on to medical school, and Marilyn Fitzgerald, who was one of the most influential members of the AAPA staff ever. And it was just the beginning. And I went from there to the nominating committee and just doing little things. And it was at the same time doing state chapter stuff. There's plenty of work to do in a state chapter. And then parlaying state chapter, going to the House of Delegates, you get a little visibility in the House of Delegates. And I chose that track. I ran for AAPA Board of Directors and lost by 400 some votes. I ran for Secretary of the AAPA and lost by 11 votes to Bill Marquardt. That hurt, 11 votes out of several thousand. But Bill is a good candidate, and also a Nova Southeastern kind of guy. But then I got involved in the House of Delegates, and that worked well. But part of it is, when you talk about the leadership skills, it's developing an ability to think strategically, to be able to articulate what you want to, your point of view in a way that makes sense, to be able to write in a compelling way, to be able to understand the finances of the organization. You know, Randy and I, before the call, were just talking about his time on the Faculty Senate and my time on the Faculty Senate. And literally, people said, you seem like you run a really, really good meeting. I think you should think about being on the Faculty Senate. And running a meeting is, sometimes people are like, oh my God, that was the worst meeting ever. And it's, you know, if you can run a good meeting and think strategically and focus on the strategic plan and influence others, that starts to show. And whether you're leading from with a title or leading from the back, just throwing out your ideas, you know, the House of Delegates is 400 people. And I swear I could craft a compelling argument in a way that I could influence enough people that I don't need a title. It's really the power of the argument that sways the day. And that's being able to understand the organization, the direction they're heading, and what the needs are, what the environment is, doing a SWOT analysis, the kinds of things that you're probably learning in this course, which is, you know, those building blocks may sound managerial, but when you translate them to leadership skills and link it to the power of the organization and the strategic plan, that's when it, you know, people like, whoa, he knows what he's doing. And then, you know, he or she knows what he's doing. And then you start getting opportunities. It's worked.
Yeah.
that's my secret sauce.
Well, and you sort of bring up an interesting point. Quick story, when in my early career, I was a state representative to the National Public Education Committee. And the chair of that committee in 76, 77, some issues occurred and she resigned. And Dan Fox was president. And I sent him, we didn't have email in those days, but I think I sent him a letter. sent him a letter that said, "This is terrible. You know, nobody knows who PAs are. And we need to have some, a better public education, effort at the national level and the state level." And I sent that to him, this little guy from Utah Academy. You know what happened? He called me and said, "Great, how would you like to be the new chair?"
That's right.
You know, and I've always said that if you want to be involved, you need to, you need to show up, you need to stand up, you need to speak up. And of course, the other thing I've learned is know when to shut up, but yeah. I haven't learned that.
Yeah,
a
lot.
But
it's a challenge for the two of us, I think. So
you know, there's so many things going on over the years now. Bill, let's talk. We've been talking a little bit about professional issues. Let's jump into some professional issue questions for you.
Okay.
In 2017, the AAPA House of Delegates approved Optimum Team Performance (OTP), and your thoughts about what the profession did in passing OTP, where they've gone, where they're going, is it working?
So there's an Einstein quote that I have used. I didn't know it was an Einstein quote, and I wasn't really quoting it. But it's, if I had an hour to address a problem, Einstein said, I'd spend 55 minutes trying to figure out what the problem is clearly, and then 5 minutes coming up with the solution. And there is clearly some problems, but my concern with OTP was it was a solution that was crafted in the minds of some people who wanted the profession to go in a certain way. And I'm not sure that there's a clear link to the problem we were trying to solve. They originally called it, but they brought the idea to the PA Education Association, and the Academy strongly believes that they are the voice of the profession, and there are four organizations that are leading the profession from various points of view, and the Academy needs to figure out how to respect that and communicate with them in an effective way. And yeah. They brought it to PAEA, and I think it was FPAR or something like that. I forget what it was.
No, full practice authority.
Right. And we went ballistic. And it's like, what are you? Because the problem we're trying to solve is, number one, the world that existed in 1967, where physician hired PAs, physician was the decision maker, physician signed on to be a mentor, physician signed on to be immediately available to provide guidance when needed. The physician signed on to have a backward-looking quality assurance plan. And they did that knowing that world doesn't exist anymore. And physicians don't have the time to do that anymore. So there are clearly problems that we need to solve. So I applaud the Academy with leading us forward. Where I get frustrated is the first tenet of OTP, which is we're in team practice with everyone and physicians aren't special. And that's not the way it's said, but if you hear them talk about it, that's what they're saying. Physicians aren't that special. And I just think, given our history, given the role that physicians play in our education today, given the role that physicians still play in many of our organizations, many of our state chapters, in many of our practices, in hospitals, in medical boards, I just don't think it makes any sense for us to thumb our nose at physicians. So I'm looking for us to figure out how to address the true problems, which are the linkage of one PA to one physician in state law. That's got to go. The whole issue of, you need to have a practice plan with a physician named. It's too fluid. Physicians are in and out of your daily practice, based on their schedules and your schedules, and that makes it difficult. But we need to still have a system that provides access of the practicing PA to guidance when they need it to solve a problem for a patient. We talk about patient-centered practice, and I always tell PA students, know what you know what you don't know, and know where to get help. And I think the last one, what I thought was beautiful about the PA-physician relationship was I would go out in the hall and pull the physician in. It didn't inconvenience the patient. I didn't need to write a referral report. I didn't need to send the chart. The physician had all the information they needed. They perhaps had a relationship. That worked really well. The mentoring and onboarding was extremely important in the early days. And then the quality care system to look back on a group of patients and say, how did the team do in caring for this patient or a patient with this kind of problem? Those are things that we have to figure out how to preserve. And I've always heard that it'll be a senior PA. I don't know that there's that many senior PAs out there that are that qualified to do that. And maybe it isn't a physician-only model, but we need to figure it out without thumbing our noses at physicians.
Let me
that's the challenge for me.
It is. And I think I'd like your take on this. I mean, one of the issues that OTP calls on is that the reduction of archaic barriers, statutory barriers, as you said, requiring, you know, a PA and a physician together. And we know now that, you know, almost 70% of all physicians are now working for somebody else.
Yeah.
As we are, and so I think you'd agree that the states probably ought to find ways to get rid of those archaic barriers.
Absolutely.
Number one, because the importance of patient care, but number two, the importance that it's causing some rift in PAs getting jobs.
Yeah, and it's also creating inefficiencies in the way that we practice that's disadvantaging us in the marketplace. You know, if a body of healthcare professionals can do it without all the shackles, and we're shackled and trying to take care of patients, we're going to lose. And I agree 100% that there are problems that we need to solve. I'd like to find a solution that doesn't involve us saying at the practice level, senior PAs are equal to physicians, done, go from it, go, we're fine.
That's kind of a slippery slope, is it not?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. The other question, the thing that I like about the one component of OTP that I like is the encouragement of states to create a PA-specific regulatory board. And as you know, five states, Arizona being one of them, maybe even a couple of more, have independent boards that are PAs, that are PA-specific. Like in Arizona, there's five PAs, two MDs, two DOs, and two patient advocates. It's a great model for PAs to take control of the regulatory components of the profession. I don't know what's, and every state's different, as you know, but working toward getting more PA-specific regulatory boards over the next 10 years would only strengthen our profession. Thoughts?
Yeah, I sit on the medical board in Connecticut, and I've been on the medical board for just about 2 years. It's been a kind of weird thing because it's been COVID related, so I've never ever met anybody on the board. But I spend all of my time disciplining physicians. There's been one PA case the whole time that I've been on the board, and we meet pretty much monthly. So the value of my time, it seems like we could do a better job. But in the state of Connecticut, the medical board doesn't have the power. It's the Department of Public Health. So even if you look and say, oh, let's turn the medical board into a PA board, that in Connecticut, that's not going to solve any problem because the Department of Public Health controls everything. They control the initial licensure. They do the fact finding when complaints are heard. They just bring it to the medical board for the final stamp. Yes, we agree with your transcript and your agreement that you hammered out, or the hearing that you led with your lawyers and everything else. The interesting part of OTP is without that last piece, Randy, I don't think the other parts can be fully envisioned, because, and I think that's where thumbing your nose at physicians in the front end makes no sense if they hold all the power on the medical boards and they say, fine, do whatever you want, have a good time, dabble around over here, but we still control your life here and your the way you are talking about physicians and the physician PA team and your lack of value for it, why would we ever let you run the candy shop? So it's an interesting one where how we evolve OTP, you know, I can't disagree with any of the four components. It's how we sequence them and what we mean by them. I can't get a clear answer for what we absolutely mean by tenant number one. If we really mean practice without physician involvement independently, then say it and see what happens. I don't think that's where we want to go, but I think there are people in the profession that would like to see it go that way. I don't think they're even close to being in the majority, but.
Yep. And maybe, you know, it's the old thing. You know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? I'm not sure that that's the direction initially that we want to go to. I think we ought to be working in the States. And, you know, for instance, are we not a profession that should be able to regulate itself?
Absolutely. At the state level? I mean, you can't call yourself a profession unless you regulate yourself. That's one of the sociologic definitions of being a profession.
Right. So the regulatory board that regulates PAs should be PA-centric.
Yeah,
which puts a lot of responsibility on us. But okay, I'm going to try to land this airplane in a minute.
Okay,
but I got a couple more, and I want to make sure we have time for questions. So, Bill, physician assistant, physician associate.
You know, it's again, this is one of those examples of what is the problem we're trying to solve. We spent $1 million identifying the problem, which is the public doesn't understand who we are. They don't understand the importance of our role. They don't understand that we practice with significant level of medical autonomy from patient to patient, that we deliver a significant amount of the healthcare in this country, that we write a significant amount of prescription in this country. We spent $1 million to prove that. And so it was, we need a public education campaign, which you pointed to in way back when. And at the same time, they said, your name is part of the problem. And I can't disagree that if we went way back to the beginning of the profession and picked a different name, which was originally physician associate, and we couldn't sell it then, if we had picked a different name, would we get more respect? Would we have more understanding? We just went through a nationwide pandemic, worldwide pandemic, and physicians, nurses, PAs, respiratory therapists, housekeeping were all key pieces to that, saving our nation. And who got credit? Doctors and nurses. So I don't know that a public education campaign is going to make us a household name and instant respect, but I do like that if we were going to change our name, and I was Speaker of the House when we talked about this in 1995, so it's been a long time coming. But I think the brand PA was essential to keep. And the consulting company said we should have picked medical care practitioner, which I just found to be the dumbest non-descriptive name going. And I'm glad we preserved PA. Do I think it's going to make a difference? I don't know. Is the Academy doing a much better job with public education and putting the right spin in the right places for us in various venues and social media and newspapers and on whatever? Yes, they're doing a much better job. So it really was an investment of the money, but I'm glad we didn't change the name from PA, because I think people do know now what a PA is.
That's really great. Do. Absolutely. Well, as a my first title was MedX. So
yes, I worked as an orderly at Wyndham Hospital in near Storrs, Connecticut, and MedX. It was MedX Fox. Ron Fox was a MedX from the New Hampshire at Dartmouth. Dartmouth had a PA program. It was a MedX PA program. And you'd hear MedX Fox, MedX Fox, paging MedX Fox. It worked.
Yeah. All right. All right. Onward and upward.
Yeah, indeed.
So Dr. Kohlhepp, I'm not going to ask you about the value of post-professional doctorates because, you know, you have one, I have one. You know, many of us decided, whether being in education or whatever reason, having a doctoral degree was important for our career.
Absolutely.
But as you know, coming up this next year, PAEA and others, you know, are looking at the whole issue of the entry-level doctoral degree. And I've spoke in favor of that with the caveat that there are some pretty significant barriers, particularly recruitment of PAs, length of program, and the diversification of the profession. Your thoughts on entry-level doctorates? I know that Dr. Simon is here and would probably have some comments on that as well.
Yeah, so I come to the conversation from having had the hat on of a dean of a school of health sciences that had 22 health professions. And originally the School of Nursing was part of the School of Health Sciences. So I watched them evolve into master's level APRN and doctorate level APRN. I was in the pharmacy school, so I watched the evolution of PharmD, and I was in the hospital when there was no PharmDs created for an entire year. There was no new pharmacist in the entire system because they moved to the six-year PharmD. And I've watched physical therapists go to the DPT to compete with chiropractors. When I was at Quinnipiac, I watched the OTs. Half the profession wanted to go to entry-level OTD. The accrediting body said yes. The professional body said no. There was absolute confusion. So we need to do it in an orderly way that everybody's on board with if we're going to do it. But I've also watched those organizations struggle. Nursing struggled. They were trying to compete with physicians and to use the title doctor, but they couldn't back it up. Many nurse practitioner programs say, oh, yes, we have doctorally trained nurse practitioners, but most of them are trained at the master's level because there's just not enough capacity with doctorally trained nurses to staff the faculty. The same thing with DPT. They struggle to have enough faculty. I just watch athletic, you know, degree creep is real. And I watched athletic training go from bachelor's to the master's. And the provost and I looked at that and said, their salary earning capacity is nowhere near what it's going to need to be to pay for this increased educational expense of going to the master's degree. And we actually closed our program. Boston University was pushing for them to move to the master's degree, and they couldn't even make it go. And they were the leaders. So degree creep is a challenge for the cost of the education. Are there sufficient doctorally trained faculty? What are you going to teach that's going to make them better clinicians, not better educators, not better leaders, not better researchers, which is post-professional doctorate, but what do they need that we're not getting an entry-level education? And I think you pointed to the one that I was really worried about with the master's degree, and I still think there was a tremendous impact, which was on the diversification of the profession. We're nowhere near where we need to be. Yeah. And I think if we move to the doctoral degree, it's going to be even more challenging, particularly if we add on another year of education or something else. But the number one is I'm so thrilled that we're, as a profession, having this conversation. Last time, competition between PA programs and one-upsmanship drove the degree, in my humble opinion. You know, new programs said, oh, we can compete with the programs that have been around because we'll give a master's degree. So,
yeah.
But I've seen enough challenges in others who have moved and can't back it up. And I just I'm 100% supportive of post-professional doctorate. The entry-level doctorate, I still have a lot of questions in my head, and I'm listening forward to the conversation. And again, what is the problem we're trying to solve? Is it to compete with physicians, nurse practitioners? I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, you know, a quote that I took from my first supervising physician so many years ago. He said, "Randy, there are three things in life that's going to make you successful." He said, as a medical professional, he said, number one is never forget it's about the patient. You know, number two, don't ever give up your integrity. And number three, kind of tongue in cheek, he said, outlive your enemies.
Yeah. Well, there, you know? I've seen that many times in stodgy old members of the medical boards or legislatures who just did not get PAs, and they were until their last dying breath, they were against us. And,
yep,
you know, so that, you had a very smart physician colleague in your early days. No wonder you're as smart as you are and as wise and worldly as you are.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm going to wrap this up. We could talk for hours, Bill. And
oh, I love talking to you.
I can't tell you how exciting this is. So lastly, Bill, you know, what would be your advice to our DMSC students and our graduates about the future of the profession?
You know, I think the things that you just mentioned, integrity. And I think as long as we're focused on our core values of the profession, and they're front and center, and we evolve, which we have done many, many times since I've been around for 40 years. The profession almost went away with the Graduate Medical National Advisory Committee when they said, get rid of all PA programs. When the residency occurred, when primary care and Bill Clinton, when the national, we've evolved and been flexible, but we've always been central to our values. One of them is patient-centered. I heard Ann Davis, who used to run our state education stuff, said, if it's not good for the patient, even if it's good for the profession, if it ain't good for the patient, we shouldn't be doing it. And I think I'm going to hold us to that one as long as I'm around. And the other is, we got to keep doing what's magical for us, which is, you know, people talk about PAs spending more time with patients. I think we are the masters at creating patient relationships where they feel like they, in that 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15 minutes, whatever it was, it wasn't longer, I can tell you from being in practice, that they felt like they were listened to and someone was trying to get an understanding from them and to help them understand things as well about why things were occurring. And I think that we build skills in PA students that allow them to establish trusting relationships with patients that are just absolutely fabulous. And the other is, the thing that's made us successful is the ability to change quickly is because we're 27 months, not 4 years plus 4 years of residency. If we want to solve a problem in America and we want to have it be a physician solution and we're changing medical students, we're not going to see that change for 8 years. And if we want to change the way PAs do things, it may be painful, but we can do it on a dime and get it changed in a couple of years. So I think, you know, going back to your supervising physician's comment about integrity, for me, it's about values. I'm a little nervous about some of the OTP stuff and where that's heading. I'm a little nervous about some of the stuff with the doctoral degrees, and nothing bad has happened so far as we've changed, but I feel so positive about the profession. And I still think, you know, most PAs who go into the profession want to take care of patients. We also need to find some people who want to go in to be decision makers in state legislatures, to be decision makers like Karen Bass in Congress or as mayor of Los Angeles. We need to have PAs who are involved in the state, the Department of Public Health, which I say is run things in Connecticut. There are no PAs in the Department of Public Health. They're all nurses and a handful of doctors. So, and then we have a couple of PAs who are university presidents now, and a couple who are in the C-suite, and I'm sure hospital system presidents. And you know, we need to do courses like this where PAs have the skills to be leaders and the confidence to be leaders, because I think we're a little lacking in our focus on leadership. And I'm thrilled that AT Still is doing this, and I was thrilled when I was partnered with Randy in our in one of our earlier iterations of Doctor of Health Sciences. And I think it was a brilliant thing for the profession to do, was to embrace professional doctorates like this. And I applaud all of you who decided to do this. When I heard about my opportunity, I said, "Okay, I'm doing it." Best thing I ever did was to get my doctorate.
Yep.
Smart, 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 smart move.
Excellent. Well, I'm gonna move to questions from folks. But let me start off with the first question. You
Okay.
know, after all we've talked about this, Bill, you're a busy guy. What the heck do you do for fun?
So I am blessed to have triplet grandchildren who are 6 years old. So I'm a big fan of baseball. I'm like the bullpen. When my son and daughter-in-law's life is too crazy and they didn't get all the pieces together, they call make the call to the bullpen and said, "Can you come over and get them on the bus, or get them off the bus, or get them to basketball camp, or can you do this?" And I just love my time spent with my grandchildren. Grandparents are best. I have an 8-year-old who's just an old soul, and he just challenges me all the time. And then for fun, I am now in a 55 and older condo community where I have enough people who play golf that I play golf 2 or 3 times a week now. It's winter, but I love college hockey, and Quinnipiac's number two in the nation. So I'm watching some of the best hockey in the nation, which is fabulous. I don't think my UConn football team did too well today. They were making a run at the end, but I think they lost. And then, you know, my wife and I we're looking to travel, and COVID got in the way, but we just got back from 2 weeks in Europe and 2 weeks out in a week and a half out in your part of the country, out when you're the former Arizona part of your life, Randy, and went to the Grand Canyon and Bryce and Zion and magical parts of the world. And I'm having fun doing that. And you know, I'm trying to work the balance of doing some nonprofit organizations to keep my leadership skills going, but trying to have fun.
That's great. How long have you been married now, Bill?
Just about 20, I think 27. Yep, just was 27 years, just about 28 soon.
Get this right. Got to get it
Yeah.
right. Yep.
Well, we got married on April 1st, which was a smart move on my part. And we got married in 1995 when the UConn women won the national championship. So I can remember that. It's actually my garage code. So I remember my anniversary every day. So it works really well. So
Oh, that's great.
the hard part is the math, Randy.
Yeah,
1995.
I'm with you. Well, let's open it up to questions from folks. I've been talking too much. Anybody have questions? Beth, I know you always have the first question, and then we'll go to Laura. Yep.
Actually, I don't. I just been it's amazing just to listen to your career and your words of wisdom, Bill, and I think that's just a powerful message. I think just saying, you
Oh,
know, whether
thank
you
you.
can lead from the front or the behind, it's like it's just that value, that servant leadership, that it's like everybody's got that great contribution point. So I just think that's just so critical for people to hear, especially now, you know.
Everybody's so focused on the title and power, and it's really, you know, the focus on the organization versus yourself is the key thing to think about. And I, you know, you captured the term servant leadership, and I think that's I've tried to live that. Whenever I'm asked the question, "What's your leadership style?" that's what I answer. So I hope I'm living up to it.
Awesome. Thank
Lori,
you.
you had a question? Thanks, Beth.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Kolob. So I finished the DMSC program yesterday.
Congratulations.
And so I have all this time now. And so I was wondering what you thought would be like other things to strengthen clinicians? Would you say like a degree in pharmacology or statistics, or what would you think would be better for a patient or a clinician service?
You know, so you know, when we talk about the future of the profession, the one thing that I have in my head that I didn't say was, and this goes to your question, Laura, is we can no longer, as a healthcare industry, focus on the sick patient in front of us one at a time. We've got to do community health. We've got to do prevention. We've got to do health promotion. We've got to do community-based healthcare and thinking about the barriers to access, the social determinants of health. So if I were to do a degree today, I would really try and do an MPH, even though I have my doctorate, I'd probably try and do my MPH just to be more solidified in the public health. I got that a little bit at my doctoral program, one course in public health, and a little bit in community health education. But I would think I would benefit a lot more and be a lot more passionate about it and able to craft some solutions if I had that kind of background. So, but you should take a break for a little while, Laura.
Thought about that too. Do type A.
Yeah, you might travel or do something fun for a little while.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't say that AT Still University and our sister school, College of Graduate Health Studies, has an MPH, and they also have a public health certificate. But anyway, food for thought.
Sign me up.
Okay, all right. Talk to Beth. Talk to Beth.
Because Randy, as you said, it's not so much that these days about the degree. It's there is some value to certificate education, and people do look at that and say badges and certificates are important. Yep. It's what did you get out of it? So that's great that you have a certificate program.
Well, I have to say I'm gonna give Bert an opportunity here to speak, but you know, Bert and Bill and I have had the opportunity of over the years to do a summer institute in leadership at Nova Southeastern, and those were fun days. And I don't want to remember how far back they were, but I think we all had darker hair. But anyway, you know. But Bert, your thoughts today?
Well, I don't know that I have. I do have one question. So, as a former program director and then as dean, Bill, I think one of the challenges that PA programs, entry-level programs face is, you know, the constant addition of, okay, now we have to add this, now we have to add that. So where is the stopping point for that? Or what can we take out? You know, you have a 50-pound sack and you can only put so much in there in 27 months. If we go longer, you know, then we start to look at, well, what's the difference between, you know, going to the PA program, going to medical school. You know, a lot of the Canadian medical schools are 3 years as it is. And, you know, every once in a while that comes up in the United States about going to a 3-year undergraduate medical education and still keep, you know, 4 years of residency, because your fourth year in medical school is usually just all electives anyways.
And interviewing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you know, I think the NCCPA might be leading the way a little bit, which is, you know, the model of PA education where you have to pretend you're learning everything so you can pass pants because you learned everything, may be the wrong thing. What is walking about knowledge? What is the knowledge you need to have? And what is the critical thinking that you need and the ability to access resources that you need to solve the problems of the patient in front of you, or to think about the broader patient from a community perspective? So I think until we get away from believing that in 27 months we can teach a full pharmacology course and then test that on a pants exam or pantry exam, do we really need to do that? Or is there key pharmacology concepts that one needs to have in a pharmacology course, and then some examples of medicines that help people build on their ability to learn about other medicines, because you can't keep adding. I know one of the things that I learned at Nova was I participated a lot in genomics, and I went to the National Genomics Institute when they had convened a study of PAs, and we decided to do an online genomics module that I developed as part of my doctorate. So I think online education as modules help. You know, the flipped classroom is hard to do in PA school. I don't know. I think Bert, you ask a great question, which is how do we, and that is the old metaphor, you know, 70 pounds of flour in a 50-pound bag. And we never not do something. It's the silly part of PA school. But what we have to preserve is the parts that allow us to build the relationship with patients and then learn to learn, lifelong learning. I think there's some room for simulation to maybe shorten some parts of learning or make them more critical thinking. A higher fidelity simulation is, I think, experiential learning may be a quicker way. I don't know. Unfortunately, I'm at a point in my career where that's somebody else's problem to solve. Yep. it's not one that I haven't thought about over 40 years. So,
yeah.
Well, that reminds me, when people ask me my opinion, I said I looked at the most recent statistics in the PA world, and I represent 6.5% of the profession, and that's people over 65. So, you know, so take that for what it's worth.
Yeah, I just turned 70 on November 5th, so I'm in a small club myself.
That's right. Well, last question, Bill. You know, and then we'll land this airplane for sure. What are you most proud of as being a PA?
I think the thing that when I was on the NCCPA board, the physician world had just started talking about competencies. And I was the chair of the committee that was charged with developing the first set of competencies for the practicing physician assistant. And so I helped lead that effort, and it involved all four organizations, which at that time was rather challenging because they weren't very happy with each other in some instances. So I was very proud of that effort. I was in the second iteration. I was a member of the group. And I was just in the third iteration. So I was the only person who was there for all three iterations. And probably the products that were the result of some of my efforts and leadership competencies, I think, is the one I'm most proud of. The thing that I think was the coolest was either going to the White House, going to testify before Congress twice, or when I was APA president, I was in Hawaii at the AMA meeting, and I was in my pajamas because it was early in the morning. And the person on the other end said, "Can you hold, please, for the Surgeon General of the United States?" And it was like, okay, yes. And I was invited to the White House for the release of the Surgeon General's report on mental health, which is being rewritten as we speak. And being there and being in the front row as a PA at a White House release from the Surgeon General, I think said a lot about our profession. And I was very proud to wave the flag at that point. And, you know, so, but it's been a fun ride. I have our favorite. So I just turned 70, so I can remember as I try and remember people's names. Our congressman from who said he caused a lot of good trouble. I'll capture his title.
Lewis.
Congressman Lewis created a lot. I feel like I've created a lot of good trouble with some good people like you and Bert over my career, and great, tremendous friendships. So,
well, thanks, Bill. And you know, and the trip is not over.
No.
So, yeah.
I'm still around.
We're so thankful for your time today and your experience sharing with us today. So thank you. For those of you that are here and will listen to this, please mark your next masterclass on your calendar. So please join us on January 23rd for our next masterclass. And our masterclass will be with Ron Rosenberg. Bill, you may remember Ron.
Yes.
A past president of AAPA in the late 70s with a really interesting path into office management or practice management over the years. Ron was also a teacher of mine at Utah Medics. And I've told him this. I hated him every minute he taught me. And I have some things that he and I have talked about over the years that he taught me that really made a difference. So I'm hoping to see you all there, and the best to all of you. You know, and Bill, thanks to you and for everybody who joined us today. And, you know, have a wonderful evening.
Happy holidays to all.
Happy holidays. Thank you.
Bye.